Hello and welcome. This week is the anniversary of one of the greatest military campaigns in history. It's the anniversary of the largest single-day amphibious invasion of all time, the D-Day attack of June 6, 1944 on Normandy in northern France. Supported by vast and overwhelming air power and using more than 5,000 ships, some 160,000 American, British, and Canadian troops assaulted German defense fortifications along a 50-mile stretch of France's Atlantic coastline. Yesterday, I received an email message from a right-wing conservative group that recalled the 1944 invasion in words that reflect the widely accepted American view of that event and of World War II. This group explained, and I quote, "The Normandy invasion began on June 4 and ended in mid-July 1944 with a decisive Allied victory. It marked the beginning of the end of Nazi Germany and the European theater of World War II. Were it not for all those brave men, so many of whom sacrificed their very lives, we'd all be living under the yoke of the Third Reich," unquote. In today's broadcast, I'll be taking a closer look at World War II, at the generally accepted view of that conflict, and provide some perspective on its place in history. For the United States, as well as for the world at large, the Second World War was by far the most devastating military conflict of modern times. In our country, the war brought profound and permanent social, governmental, and cultural changes, and has had a great impact on how Americans regard themselves and their country's place in the world. This global clash with the United States and the other allies on one side, and Nazi Germany, imperialist Japan, and the other Axis countries on the other, is routinely portrayed in the U.S. as the Good War, a morally clear-cut conflict between good and evil. In the view of British author and historian Paul Addison, the war, quote, "served a generation of Britons and Americans as a myth which enshrined their essential purity, a parable of good and evil." Dwight Eisenhower, who was the supreme wartime commander of American and Allied forces in Europe during the war, and later U.S. president for 8 years, called the fight against Nazi Germany the Great Crusade. And President Bill Clinton said in a major speech that in World War II, the United States, as he put it, saved the world from tyranny. Americans are also told that this was an unavoidable and necessary war, one that the U.S. had to wage to keep from being enslaved by cruel and ruthless dictators. Whatever doubts or misgivings Americans may have had about their country's role in Vietnam, in Iraq, or in other overseas conflicts, including Afghanistan today, most accept that the sacrifices made by the U.S. in World War II, especially in defeating Hitler's Germany, were entirely justified and worthwhile. For more than 60 years, this view has been reinforced in countless motion pictures, on television, by teachers, in textbooks, and by political leaders. The reverential way that the U.S. role in the war has been portrayed moved Bruce Russett, a professor of political science at Yale University, to write, quote, "Participation in the war against Hitler remains almost wholly sacrosanct, nearly in the realm of theology. Whatever criticisms of 20th century American policy are put forth, United States participation in World War II remains almost entirely immune. According to our national mythology, that was a good war, one of the few for which the benefits clearly outweighed the costs. Except for a few books published shortly after the war and quickly forgotten, this orthodoxy has been essentially unchallenged," unquote. How accurate is this hallowed portrayal of America's role in World War II? As we shall see, it does not hold up under close examination. First, a look at the outbreak of war in Europe. When the leaders of Britain and France declared war against Germany on September 3, 1939, they announced that they were doing so because German military forces had attacked Poland, thereby threatening Polish independence. In going to war against Germany, the British and French leaders transformed what was then a geographically limited two-day-old clash between Germany and Poland into a continental, European-wide conflict. It soon became obvious that the British-French justification for going to war was not sincere. When Soviet-Russian forces attacked Poland from the east 2 weeks later, ultimately taking over more Polish territory than did Germany, the leaders of Britain and France did not declare war against the Soviet Union. And although Britain and France went to war supposedly to protect Polish independence, at the end of the fighting in 1945, after 5.5 years of horrific struggle, death, and suffering, Poland was still not free, but instead was entirely under the brutal rule of Soviet Russia. Sir Basil Little Hart, an outstanding 20th century British military historian, put it this way, quote, "The Western Allies entered the war with a twofold object. The immediate purpose was to fulfill their promise to preserve the independence of Poland. The ultimate purpose was to remove a political menace to themselves and thus ensure their own security. In the outcome, they failed in both purposes. Not only did they fail to prevent Poland from being overcome in the first place and partitioned between Germany and Russia, but after 6 years of war, which ended in apparent victory, they were forced to acquiesce in Russia's domination of Poland, abandoning their pledges to the Poles who had fought on their side," unquote. In 1940, shortly after he was named Prime Minister, Winston Churchill spelled out in two often quoted speeches his reasons for continuing Britain's war against Germany. In his famous Blood, Sweat, and Tears speech, the great British wartime leader said that unless Germany was defeated, there would be, as he put it, no survival for the British Empire, no survival for all that the British Empire has stood for, unquote. A few weeks later, in his Finest Hour address, Churchill said, "Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire," unquote. How strange these words sound today. Even though Britain supposedly won, or at least was on the winning side in the war, the once mighty British Empire has vanished into history. No British leader today would dare defend the often brutal record of British imperialism, including killing and bombing in order to maintain exploitative colonial rule over millions in Asia and Africa. Nor would any British leader today dare to justify killing people in order to uphold Christian civilization, not least for fear of offending Britain's large and rapidly growing non-Christian population. Americans like to believe that good guys win and bad guys lose, and in international affairs that good countries win wars and bad countries lose them. In keeping with this view, Americans are encouraged to believe that the U.S. role in defeating Germany and Japan demonstrated the righteousness of the American way and the superiority of our country's form of government and society. But if there is any validity to this view, it would be at least as accurate to say that the war's outcome showed the righteousness of the Soviet way and the superiority of the Soviet communist form of government and society. Indeed, for decades, that was a proud claim of Moscow's leaders. In fact, Hitler's Germany was defeated first and foremost by the Soviet Union. Some 70-80% of German combat forces were destroyed by the Soviet military on the Eastern Front. The D-Day landing in France by American and British forces, which is often portrayed in the United States as a critically important military blow against Nazi Germany, was launched, as mentioned, in June 1944. That is, less than a year before the end of the war in Europe, and months after the great Soviet military victories at Stalingrad and Kursk, which were decisive in Germany's defeat. What were the American goals in World War II, and how successful was the U.S. in achieving them? In 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt, together with the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, issued a formal declaration of Allied war aims, the much-publicized Atlantic Charter. In it, the United States and Britain declared that they sought, quote, no territorial changes that do not accord with the freely expressed wishes of the peoples concerned, that they would, quote, respect the right of all peoples to choose the form of governments under which they will live, and that they would strive to see sovereign states, sovereign rights, and self-government restored to those who have been forcibly deprived of them, unquote. It soon became apparent, though, that this solemn pledge of freedom and self-government for all peoples was little more than empty propaganda. This is hardly surprising given that America's two most important military allies in the war were Great Britain and the Soviet Union, that is, the world's foremost imperialist power and the world's cruelest tyranny. At the outbreak of war in 1939, Britain ruled over the largest colonial empire in history, holding more millions of people against their will than any regime before or since. This vast empire included what is now India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Malaysia, Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and South Africa. America's other great wartime ally, the Soviet Union, was, by any objective measure, the most tyrannical or oppressive regime of its time, and a vastly more cruel despotism than Hitler's Germany. As historians acknowledge, the victims of Soviet dictator Stalin greatly outnumber those who perished as a result of Hitler's policies. Robert Conquest, a prominent scholar of 20th century Russian history, estimates the number of those who lost their lives as a consequence of Stalin's policies as no fewer than 20 million. During the war, the United States helped substantially to maintain Stalin's tyranny and to aid the Soviet Union in oppressing additional millions of Europeans, while also helping Britain to maintain or reestablish its imperial rule over many millions in Asia and Africa. Paul Fussell, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who served in World War II as a U.S. Army lieutenant, wrote in his acclaimed book, Wartime, that, as he put it, the Allied war has been sanitized and romanticized almost beyond recognition by the sentimental, the loony patriotic, the ignorant, and the bloodthirsty. An important feature of this sanitized view is the belief that whereas the Nazi German regime was responsible for many terrible war crimes and atrocities, the Allies, and especially the United States, waged war humanely. In fact, the record of Allied misdeeds is a long one and includes the British-American bombing of German cities, a terroristic campaign that took the lives of more than half a million civilians, the genocidal ethnic cleansing of millions of civilians in Eastern and Central Europe, and the large-scale post-war mistreatment of German prisoners. Edgar L. Jones served as an ambulance driver, a merchant seaman, an army historian, and a war correspondent. He wrote an article based on 40 months of war duty and five major battles, dispelling some of the myths about the Americans' role in that war. He told readers of the Atlantic Monthly, quote, "What kind of war do civilians suppose we fought anyway? We shot prisoners in cold blood, wiped out hospitals, strafed lifeboats, killed or mistreated enemy civilians, finished off the enemy wounded, tossed the dying into a hole with the dead, and in the Pacific boiled the flesh off enemy skulls to make table ornaments for sweethearts or carve their bones into letter openers." Shortly after the end of the war, the victorious powers put Germany's wartime leaders on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity. In doing so, the U.S. and its allies held German leaders to a standard that they did not respect themselves. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson was not the only high-ranking American official to acknowledge, at least in private, that the claim of unique Allied righteousness was mere pretense. In a letter to the President written while he was serving as the Chief U.S. Prosecutor at the Great Nuremberg Trial of 1945-46, Jackson acknowledged that the Allies, and these are his words, have done or are doing some of the very things we are prosecuting the Germans for. The French are so violating the Geneva Convention in the treatment of German prisoners of war that our command is taking back prisoners sent to them for forced labor in France. We are prosecuting plunder and our allies are practicing it. We say aggressive war is a crime and one of our allies asserts sovereignty over the Baltic states based on no title except conquest. At the conclusion of the Nuremberg trial of 1945-46, the respected British weekly The Economist cited Soviet crimes and then added, "Nor should the Western world console itself that the Russians alone stand condemned at the bar of the Allies' own justice." The Economist editorial went on, quote, "Among crimes against humanity stands the offense of the indiscriminate bombing of civilian populations. Can the Americans who dropped the atom bomb and the British who destroyed the cities of Western Germany plead not guilty on this count? Crimes against humanity also include the mass expulsion of populations. Can the Anglo-Saxon leaders who at Potsdam condoned the expulsion of millions of Germans from their homes hold themselves completely innocent? The nations sitting in judgment at Nuremberg have so clearly proclaimed themselves exempt from the law which they have administered." Unquote. Another popular American assumption is that this country's enemies in World War II were all non-democratic dictatorships. In fact, on each side, there were regimes that were repressive or dictatorial, as well as governments that had broad public support. Many of the countries allied with the U.S. were headed by governments that were oppressive, dictatorial, or otherwise non-democratic. Finland, a democratic republic, was an important wartime partner of Hitler's Germany. In crass violation of their own solemnly proclaimed principles, the U.S., British, and Soviet statesmen disposed of tens of millions of people with no regard for their wishes. To solidify the Allied wartime coalition, which was formally known as the United Nations, President Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Churchill, and Soviet Premier Stalin met together on two occasions, in November 1943 at Tehran in occupied Iran, and in February 1945 in Yalta in Soviet Crimea. The three Allied leaders accomplished what they accused the Axis leaders of Germany, Italy, and Japan of conspiring to achieve: world domination. During a 1942 meeting in Washington, President Roosevelt candidly told the Soviet foreign minister that, as he put it, the United States, England, and Russia, and perhaps China, should police the world and enforce disarmament of all others by inspection. To secure the global rule of the victorious powers after the war, the big three Allied leaders established the United Nations organization to serve as a permanent world police force. Once Germany and Japan were defeated, though, the U.S. and the Soviet Union squared off against each other, which made it impossible for the U.N. to function as President Roosevelt had intended. While the U.S. and Soviet Union each sought for decades to secure hegemony in its own sphere of influence, the two superpowers were also rivals in a decades-long struggle for global supremacy. In his book, A People's History of the United States, historian Howard Zinn wrote, quote, "The victors were the Soviet Union and the United States, also England, France, and Nationalist China, but they were weak. Both these countries now went to work, without swastikas, goose-stepping, or officially declared racism, but under the cover of socialism on the one side and democracy on the other, to carve out their own empires of influence. They proceeded to share and contest with one another the domination of the world, to build military machines far greater than the fascist countries had built, to control the destinies of more countries than Hitler, Mussolini, and Japan had been able to. They also acted to control their own populations, each country with its own techniques, crude in the Soviet Union, sophisticated in the United States, to make their rule secure, unquote. The United States officially entered World War II after the Japanese attack on the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii on December 7, 1941. Until then, the U.S. was officially a neutral country, and most Americans wanted to keep out of the war that was then raging in Europe and Asia. In spite of the country's neutral status, President Roosevelt and his administration, together with much of the U.S. media, prodded the American people into supporting war against Germany. A large-scale propaganda campaign was mounted to persuade Americans that Hitler and his Nazi henchmen or hordes were doing everything in their power to take over and enslave the entire world, and that war with Hitler's Germany was inevitable. As part of this effort, the president and other high-ranking American officials broadcast fantastic lies about supposed plans by Hitler and his government to attack the United States and impose a global dictatorship. President Roosevelt's record of lies is acknowledged even by his admirers. Among those who sought to justify his policy is the eminent American historian Thomas A. Bailey, who wrote, "Franklin Roosevelt repeatedly deceived the American people during the period before Pearl Harbor. He was like the physician who must tell the patient lies for the patient's own good. The country was overwhelmingly non-interventionist to the very day of Pearl Harbor, and an overt attempt to lead the people into war would have resulted in certain failure and an almost certain ousting of Roosevelt in 1940 with a complete defeat of his ultimate aims," unquote. Professor Bailey went on to offer a cynical view of American democracy. A president who cannot entrust the people with the truth betrays a certain lack of faith in the basic tenets of democracy. But because the masses are notoriously short-sighted and generally cannot see the danger until it is at their throats, our statesmen are forced to deceive them into an awareness of their own long-term interest. This is clearly what Roosevelt had to do, and who shall say that posterity will not thank him for it, unquote. As part of the U.S. government's campaign to incite war, President Roosevelt in 1941 ordered the U.S. Navy to help British forces in attacking German vessels in the Atlantic. This was reinforced by a presidential shoot-on-sight order to the U.S. Navy against German and Italian ships. Roosevelt's goal was to provoke an incident that would provide a pretext for open war. Hitler, for his part, was anxious to avoid conflict with the United States. The German leader responded to the U.S. government's blatantly illegal provocations by ordering his Navy commanders to avoid clashes with U.S. ships. Also, in crass violation of international law, the officially neutral U.S. government provided massive so-called lend-lease aid to Germany's enemies, especially Britain and its empire, as well as to Soviet Russia. Two prominent American historians, Alan Nevins and Henry Steele Cominger, noted that this 1941 lend-lease measure was clearly unneutral, but the United States, committed now to the defeat of Germany, was not to be stayed by the niceties of international law. Other equally unneutral acts followed: the seizure of Allied shipping, the freezing of Allied funds, the transfer of tankers to Britain, the occupation of Greenland and later of Iceland, the extension of lend-lease to the new ally, Russia, and the presidential order to shoot on sight any enemy submarines, unquote. Well, at this point, we'll take a break and resume in a few minutes with the second half of this broadcast. Welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about World War II and particularly the United States' involvement in that great conflict. I was citing historians who were looking and presenting a different view than the one most Americans are used to about the United States policy in the months leading up to the Pearl Harbor attack, which brought the U.S. Formally into World War II. In the view of the British historian J.F.C. Fuller, President Roosevelt, during the period of 1940-41, in his words, left no stone unturned to provoke Hitler to declare war on the very people to whom he ardently promised peace. Roosevelt provided Great Britain with American destroyers. He landed American troops in Iceland, and he set out to patrol the Atlantic seaways in order to safeguard British convoys, all of which were acts of war. In spite of his manifold enunciations to keep the United States out of the war, he was bent on provoking some incident which would bring them into it, unquote. The Roosevelt administration's policies were so belligerent and unlawful that Admiral Harold R. Stark, who was chief of U.S. Naval Operations, acknowledged in a confidential memorandum written in September 1941 for the president, quote, "He, Hitler, has every excuse in the world to declare war on us now, if he were of a mind to." Across Europe and Asia, the Second World War brought mass destruction, death to tens of millions of men, women, and children, and great suffering to many more. Americans, though, were spared the horrors of large-scale bombing, combat fighting on their home soil, or occupation by foreign armies. At the end of the war, the United States was the only major nation not shattered in the global conflict. It emerged as the world's preeminent economic, military, and financial power. For the United States, the half-century from the end of World War II in 1945 to the mid-1990s was an era of spectacular economic growth and unmatched global stature. Louis Lapham, an author and for years editor of Harper's Magazine, put it this way, quote, "In 1945, the United States inherited the earth. At the end of World War II, what was left of Western civilization passed into the American account. The war had also prompted the country to invent a miraculous economic machine that seemed to grant as many wishes as were asked of it. The continental United States had escaped the plague of war, and so it was easy enough for the heirs to believe that they had been anointed by God," unquote. But were Americans really better off than if they had stayed out of World War II? Among those who has not thought so is Professor Bruce Russert, who wrote, "American participation in World War II had very little effect on the essential structure of international politics thereafter, and probably did little either to advance the material welfare of most Americans or to make the nation secure from more foreign military threats. In fact, most Americans probably would have been no worse off and possibly a little better if the United States had never become a belligerent. I personally find it hard to develop a very emphatic preference for Stalinist Russia over Hitlerite Germany. In cold-blooded realist terms, Nazism as an ideology was almost certainly less dangerous to the United States than is communism." Although Third Reich Germany and Imperial Japan were destroyed, the United States and Britain failed to achieve the political goals proclaimed by their leaders. In August 1945, the prestigious British weekly The Economist noted, quote, "At the end of a mighty war fought to defeat Hitlerism, the Allies are making a Hitlerian peace. This is the real measure of their failure," unquote. Among those who were not happy about the war's outcome was British historian Basil Little Hart, who wrote, all the effort that was put into the destruction of Hitlerite Germany resulted in a Europe so devastated and weakened in the process that its powers of resistance was much reduced in the face of a fresh and greater menace. And Britain, in common with her European neighbors, had become a poor dependent of the United States. These are the hard facts underlying the victory that was so hopefully pursued and so painfully achieved. After the colossal weight of both Russia and America had been drawn into the scales against Germany, the outcome dispelled the persistent popular illusion that victory spelt peace. It confirmed the warning of past experience that victory is a mirage in the desert that a long war creates when waged with modern weapons and unlimited methods. End of quote. At the end of the war, Europe, for the first time in its history, was no longer master of its own destiny, but was instead under the dominion of two great outer European powers, the United States and the Soviet Union, which, for political and ideological reasons, had no special interest in or concern for European culture or Western civilization. In the view of Charles A. Lindbergh, the world-famous author and aviator, the war was a great setback for the West. 25 years after the end of the conflict, he wrote, "We won the war in a military sense, but in a broader sense, it seems to me, we lost it, for our Western civilization is less respected and secure than it was before. In order to defeat Germany and Japan, we supported the still greater menaces of Russia and China, which now confront us in a nuclear weapon era. Poland was not saved. Much of our Western culture was destroyed. We lost the genetic heredity formed through eons in many million lives. It is alarmingly possible that World War II marks the beginning of our Western civilization's breakdown, as it already marks the breakdown of the greatest empire ever built by man." Unquote. The outcome of the U.S. and British role in the war moved British historian J.F.C. Fuller to write, "What persuaded them," Roosevelt and Churchill, "to adopt so fatal a policy? We hazard to reply, blind hatred. Their hearts ran away with their heads, and their emotions befogged their reason. For them, the war was not a political conflict in the normal meaning of the words. It was a Manichaean contest between good and evil. And to carry their people along with them, they unleashed a vitriolic propaganda against the devil they had invoked." Even after the passage of so many years, the hatred has endured. American schools, the U.S. mass media, government agencies, and political leaders have, for decades, carried on a campaign of emotion-laden, one-sided propaganda to uphold the national mythology of World War II. How a nation views the past is not a trivial or merely academic exercise. Our perspective on history profoundly shapes our actions in the present, often with grave consequences for the future. Drawing conclusions from our understanding of the past, we make or support policies that greatly impact many lives. The familiar American portrayal of World War II and the good war mythology of the U.S. role in it is not merely bad history. It has helped greatly to support and justify a series of arrogant U.S. foreign policy adventures with harmful consequences for both America and the world. Since 1945, American presidents have repeatedly sought to justify U.S. military actions in foreign countries by recalling the good war, and in particular, the U.S. role in defeating Germany. During the 1960s, President Lyndon Johnson sought to win support for his Vietnam War policy with historically false portrayals of World War II and Hitler's Germany. This moved historian Murray Rothbard to write in 1968, I'm quoting, "World War II is the last war myth left, the myth that the old left clings to in pure desperation, the myth that here at least was a good war. Here was a war in which America was in the right. World War II is the war thrown into our faces by the war-making establishment as it tries, in each war that we face, to wrap itself in the mantle of good and righteous World War II." Unquote. In recent years, American political leaders have tried to gain support for war against Iraq and Iran by drawing historical parallels between Hitler and the leaders of those two Middle East countries. Many Americans are understandably outraged by the deceit and falsehoods of President George W. Bush and his administration in seeking public support for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. But as we have seen, presidential deception to justify war did not start with him. Americans who expressed admiration for the U.S. role in World War II and for Franklin Roosevelt's presidential leadership have little moral right to complain when presidents follow his example and lead the country into war by breaking the law, subverting the Constitution, and lying to the people. If the history of war and conflict teaches us anything, it is the danger of arrogance and hubris, that is, the danger of going to war because a nation's leaders are convinced of their own righteousness or have persuaded themselves and the public that a foreign country should be attacked because its government or society is not merely alien, hostile, or threatening, but evil. This is perhaps the most harmful legacy of America's national mythology about World War II, the notion that worthwhile or justifiable wars are fought against countries headed by supposedly evil regimes. And it is this very outlook that moved President George W. Bush to refer to his so-called war on terrorism as a crusade, and in a major speech, to proclaim a U.S. foreign policy dedicated to, as he put it, ending tyranny in the world. A nation should go to war only after prudent consideration, after carefully weighing the possible consequences, and only for the most compelling of reasons, after all other alternatives have been exhausted, and as a last resort. This is especially true given the awesome destructive power of modern weapons, and because, as World War II, the so-called good war, so tragically attests, wars rarely turn out the way anyone expects. I want to expand a little bit on some of the themes and points that I was making earlier in this broadcast. It's the point that nowadays the important legacy of Franklin Roosevelt is respected by political leaders and by large numbers of Americans who call themselves conservative or liberal. The great hero for many American conservatives is Ronald Reagan. Well, amazingly enough, Ronald Reagan was a man who praised and gave honor to Franklin Roosevelt. In fact, during World War II, Ronald Reagan spent his time helping to make propaganda movies for the United States government. For him, World War II was certainly the good war. But this is a very odd view for Americans who are traditionally conservative. During the 1930s, American conservatives, authentic American conservatives, for the most part hated Roosevelt. They looked at him as a man who had usurped enormous power, had subverted the Constitution of the United States, had greatly expanded the federal government beyond what anybody had ever envisioned before him. Authentic conservatives during the 1930s, 40s, and up until the 50s regarded Franklin Roosevelt with loathing, with contempt. But today, those people in America who call themselves conservatives have not only accepted, but embraced the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt. And in doing so, they show themselves betraying the legacy of conservatism that used to be in place in the United States. One obvious example of that is that traditional conservatives upheld the policy of non-intervention in foreign wars that was laid out most eloquently by George Washington in his famous farewell address. Conservatives used to oppose strongly what George Washington called a passionate attachment to other countries. But nowadays, those politicians, with very few exceptions, who call themselves conservatives, uphold an enormous U.S. military force and presence in the world, a military force that today as large, it is estimated, as that of the rest of the world put together. Many of these so-called conservatives in the United States are ardent, even mindless, supporters of the special U.S. relationship with Israel. And this, again, is a blatant betrayal of the traditional conservative view that people who call themselves conservatives in the United States had for many, many decades in this country. By the same token, liberals who uphold the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt have no moral right to complain when George W. Bush or other American presidents lie to the public or get the American people and the American nation involved in wars on the basis of deceitful pretexts. One of the most remarkable aspects, as I have tried to emphasize over and over, of the Obama administration is not that it differs radically from the administration of George W. Bush, despite what people like Rush Limbaugh say, but how similar it is. And most notably, Barack Obama has sent the United States or launched the United States into the civil conflict, the internal conflict in Libya, on the basis that he was doing this in the name of humanity, supposedly for good or righteous reasons. But he did so in blatant violation of the U.S. Constitution, which lays out that war is to be declared by Congress. In fact, Barack Obama sent U.S. forces into the Libya conflict not only without consulting with Congress, but without any debate whatsoever. And now he's violated even the War Powers Act in continuing this role and involvement in the conflict. Now, the important point here is how our understanding of World War II has perverted our understanding of America's role in the world and the role of the government, both by those who call themselves conservative and by those who call themselves liberal in our society. President Bill Clinton, as I mentioned, said in a speech that the United States saved the world from tyranny in World War II. Of course, that's complete nonsense. The United States was the most important military ally in World War II of the most tyrannical regime in the world at the time, the Soviet Union. And a statement like that sounds good by President Clinton or other American presidents. They may sound good, make Americans feel good, but they're not only not true, they're dangerous deceits, they're dangerous lies, because America today, faced with the enormous problems that we face internally and around the world, require more than ever realism, sobriety, and more than ever it's important to shake off silly, self-gratifying delusions and denial about reality. To go back to the statement made at the beginning of the broadcast, I was quoting from a statement by a right-wing conservative group that threw out the idea that if the United States had not landed troops in D-Day, that the United States would have been dominated by Third Reich Germany. Well, this is complete nonsense. It's consistent with the enormous campaign of propaganda that continues to this day about Hitler's Germany, Third Reich, and so forth, and World War II, and the portrayal of it as a country ruled by mad leaders bent on world domination. In fact, the United States could have very easily stayed out of World War II, certainly out of the Atlantic theater of World War II. And it would have, the United States would have done much better to have devoted itself to the most important things about that are essential for the health and welfare of any country. Not its overseas power, not its overseas possessions, not its military hardware, but the character, the quality, the health of its people. One of the greatest mistakes that empires make throughout history is confusing the symptoms with the source, confusing the outward trappings of power with real internal health and goodness of a society and the basic inner worth of any good country. There's much more that can be said about World War II, and fortunately, as time goes on, there's more and more reassessment in recent years by people who are willing to take a secondary look, a look at the legacy of World War II, which was so entrenched during the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. A few books that I recommend in that regard is Patrick Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. Patrick Buchanan is a extraordinarily skilled synthesist and wordsmith, able to express himself in a convincing and persuasive way. His book makes very clear, I think, persuasively, convincingly clear to any open-minded person, that contrary to the notions that we've been told over and over, Hitler's ambitions were actually rather quite limited. That not only did he not want war with the United States, he wanted very much peace and no war with Britain. And the idea that Hitler's Germany could have been a threat to the United States when it was unable to subdue even Britain is nonsense. But Patrick Buchanan's book is very valuable in that regard. Another book that is also a revisionist or nonconformist book about World War II that's well worth reading is one that had came out about the same time, entitled Human Smoke. The author of the book is Nicholson Baker, and he writes his book on the beginnings of World War II from a perspective that is very different than Pat Buchanan's. Nicholson Baker is essentially a pacifist, a leftist. Pat Buchanan, of course, is a paleoconservative, a traditional conservative. But in spite of the different perspectives that they start with, each of these two authors are persuasive and compelling in dismantling and discrediting a lot of the most common assumptions, American assumptions, about World War II as the supposed good war between good and evil. If you're interested, if you enjoy these broadcasts, I urge you to write to me about your comments, questions, and so forth, not only about this broadcast, but others in this series. I urge you to take a look at some of the many articles that are posted on our website, not only produced by the IHR, but from many other sources as well, which help provide, I think, very useful perspective on the world we live in today. Well, that concludes this week's broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. I hope you'll join me for the next one. Thank you.